Imagine you are an ancient person walking through the desert and you just stumble upon a crashed alien spaceship.
Oh, wow.
Right. And you manage to pry a piece of the metallic hull off, you hammer it down, and you fashion it into a ceremonial dagger for your king.
Which sounds completely like a sci-fi movie.
It really does. But the crazy thing is, thousands of years before the Iron Age officially began, humanity was doing exactly that.
Yes, they absolutely were.
And that is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are exploring a massive, expansive Wikipedia repository on the Iron Age today. And our mission is to explore how human civilization leveled up from bronze to iron.
A massive leap for humanity.
It really was. Okay, let's unpack this because the transition wasn't just some obvious technological stepping stone that everyone was thrilled to take, you
Yeah,
know.
not at all.
It was a monumental hurdle of physics, of chemistry, and sheer willpower, and it was sparked by a global supply chain crisis that fundamentally redefined the world.
Yeah, and the scale of that innovation is staggering when you consider where it actually started.
Right.
To really understand the Iron Age, we have to strip away the misconception that began the first time a human being held an iron object.
Because they had it way earlier.
Exactly. As you pointed out with that spaceship analogy, early humans possessed iron artifacts millennia before they could actually extract iron from the earth.
Right, because that early material was meteoric iron, right? Like
Yeah.
a natural alloy of iron and nickel that literally fell from outer space.
Yeah, literally from the sky.
The sources highlight nine small iron beads found in burials at Gerza in Lower Egypt. And those date all the way back to 3200 BC.
Which is incredibly early.
Right. Then you have King Tutankhamun's famous dagger from the 13th century BC. Modern X-ray fluorescence analysis actually proved the blade was forged from a meteorite that landed in northern Egypt.
It's amazing that we can trace it back to that specific impact.
It really is. But I mean, scavenging fragments of a meteorite is incredible, sure, but it doesn't spark an industrial revolution.
No, it doesn't.
It's rare, it's highly prized, and it is completely unscalable.
What's fascinating here is the massive gulf between scavenging a raw extraterrestrial material and industrializing a terrestrial one.
Right, finding it versus making it.
Exactly. True Iron Age culture isn't defined by a pharaoh owning a magical space dagger. It's defined by the mass production of smelted iron, and specifically, the intentional creation of carbon steel alloys.
Okay, wait, I'm stuck on the physics here. Because if I'm an ancient blacksmith, my standard Neolithic kiln, which, I mean, they were using those as far back as 6000 BC, hits maybe 900 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, right around there.
And that is plenty hot to melt copper, which liquefies around 1085 degrees.
Right.
And it's way more than enough for tin, which melts at an incredibly low 232 degrees.
Right, it melts super
So
easily.
you mix those together, you get bronze. It's essentially just advanced pottery technology applied to rocks. But if I throw terrestrial iron ore into that same 900 degree kiln, absolutely nothing happens, right?
Nothing but warm rocks.
Wow.
Yeah, to even begin smelting iron, you have to hit temperatures above 12,250 degrees Celsius.
That is a huge jump.
It is. And this is the thermodynamic hurdle that kept the Bronze Age going for thousands of years, even though literal mountains of iron ore were sitting right under their feet the whole time.
Just waiting there.
Yeah, hitting 1,250 degrees requires building entirely new, highly complex furnaces with forced air bellows.
And even if I manage to build that furnace, the iron doesn't melt into a nice, easy to pour liquid like bronze does it?
Not at all. Because ancient furnaces still couldn't reach the true melting point of pure iron, which is over 1500 degrees Celsius, the iron ore doesn't liquefy.
So what does it do?
Well, the carbon monoxide in the furnace basically strips the oxygen away from the iron oxide.
Here.
And what it leaves behind is this glowing, spongy mass of solid iron mixed with liquid rock and impurities.
Oh,
Yeah,
gross.
it's called a bloom.
So you have this searing, hot, I don't know, metallic sponge dripping with liquid glass and slag.
Exactly. And the only way to make it usable is to drag that 1250 degree bloom out of the furnace with tongs and immediately start beating it with a hammer.
Oh my God.
You are literally squeezing the liquid slag out of the solid iron sponge through sheer physical force.
Which sounds
It was
exhausting.
brutal work. And this is actually where we get the term wrought iron. It is iron that has been worked or wrought by hand.
But pure wrought iron is relatively soft, isn't it? I mean, you might think of iron today as this incredibly sturdy modern building block. But put yourself in the shoes of a 12th century BC farmer for a second.
Right.
A pure iron sword will bend if you hit a shield too hard.
It absolutely will.
But a good bronze sword will hold its edge beautifully. So to them, iron wasn't an upgrade. It was a cheap, frustrating downgrade.
Yeah, it really was.
Why would I spend decades trying to invent a 12,250-degree forced air furnace and break my back hammering a glowing sponge just to get a metal that is worse than the bronze I already have? It makes absolutely no economic sense.
Well, they didn't want to. They were forced to.
Really?
Yeah. Ancient peoples did not wake up one day and decide to invent the Iron Age. They were pushed into it by a systemic collapse.
Oh, wow.
See, to make iron harder than bronze, you have to turn it into steel.
Right, by introducing carbon.
Exactly. Think of pure iron at a molecular level, like a ball pit filled with large, identical plastic balls.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you step into that pit, the balls shift and slide past one another really easily.
Yeah.
That is why pure iron is soft and bends.
Got it.
Now imagine pouring thousands of tiny marbles into that same ball pit.
Oh, they'd fall right into all the little gaps.
Right. They fall into all the empty gaps between the large balls, jamming the entire structure so the large balls can no longer slide.
That makes perfect sense.
Those tiny marbles are the carbon atoms from the charcoal fire diffusing into the iron's crystalline lattice.
Wow.
That is how you create carbon steel, which is infinitely harder, lighter, and more durable than bronze. But figuring out how to regulate that carbon admixture was a desperate trial-and-error process born out of the Bronze Age collapse.
So around 1200 BC, the highly interconnected, globalized world of the ancient Near East and Eastern Mediterranean simply fractured. Palaces burned, empires fell, and international trade routes were completely severed.
Yeah, it was chaotic. We have to look at a scholar named Anthony Snodgrass here. His theory, detailed in the sources, points to a catastrophic disruption in the supply of tin.
Right, because you need tin for bronze.
Exactly. Copper is relatively common in the Mediterranean, but tin is incredibly rare. During the Bronze Age, tin had to be shipped over massive distances, sometimes overland, all the way from ancient Afghanistan.
So it was the ancient world's equivalent of crude oil? Or, I don't know, semiconductor chips today.
That is a perfect analogy. The trade routes freeze. Suddenly you have zero tin.
And if you have no tin, you cannot make bronze.
Exactly. You can't forge new plows for your agriculture. You can't equip your soldiers to defend the city walls. It is a true existential crisis.
And at first they panicked, right? The archaeological record shows them frantically recycling old bronze implements, like melting down statues and heirloom weapons.
Anything they could find.
But eventually, the scrap runs out. You are surrounded by hostile forces, you are trying to survive, and you are staring at these terrestrial iron ores that you previously ignored. So what does this all mean? We are looking at a prehistoric supply chain crisis forcing a technological leap.
It is a profound testament to human resilience, really. When the global network collapsed, local innovation took over.
They had no choice.
Right. Metal workers desperately experimented until they mastered the forced air furnace, the brutal physical labor of hot working the bloom, and eventually the precise chemistry of carbon steel.
What strikes me is that once the trade routes eventually recovered and tin became available again, nobody went back to bronze for their tools.
No, the genie was out of the bottle.
Right, iron was ubiquitous, it was in the ground everywhere, and forged steel was vastly superior to cast bronze. The crisis had permanently forced humanity to level up.
And, you know, the sources also debunk a very stubborn old myth regarding this transition.
Oh, about the Hittites.
Yes. For a long time, historians claimed that the Hittite Empire in Anatolia had a strict monopoly on iron smelting, and they used this closely guarded secret weapon to conquer their neighbors.
That's what I was taught in school, honestly.
A lot of people were. But modern archaeological consensus shows that simply isn't true. Iron objects from that era are found equally distributed in Egypt, the Levant, and other regions.
So it wasn't a state secret.
No. The knowledge was spreading organically as a widespread reaction to the tin shortage, not as some state-kept military secret.
So if a supply chain crisis forced the Mediterranean into the Iron Age out of desperation, what happens to an isolated superpower that actually has the luxury of choosing? Do they embrace it?
Well,
here's where it gets really interesting, because the Egyptian relationship with iron is deeply tied to their theology. You would think a massive superpower would jump all over this military advancement, but they resisted it for centuries.
Yeah, iron is exceptionally scarce in ancient Egyptian antiquities.
Which is wild.
It is, because meteorites fall from the sky and terrestrial iron is found in the harsh, unlivable deserts surrounding the Nile Valley. The Egyptians viewed iron as an impure metal.
Right, they associate it specifically with Seth.
Exactly, Seth, the god of chaos, storms, and the desert.
They literally called it the bone of Seth.
And because of that deeply ingrained cultural and religious baggage, they refused to use it for anything ceremonial or significant. They possessed the metallurgical knowledge, but they stubbornly stuck with bronze as their primary metal.
It's like a modern society flat out refusing to adopt the internet because they decide it's inherently evil.
That's a great way to put it.
You might feel morally superior, but eventually you are going to get outpaced by your tech-savvy neighbors. Egypt held onto bronze right up until the Neo-Assyrian Empire, wielding hardened iron weapons, came knocking and conquered them in 671 BC.
It is a stark reminder that technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It has to navigate the cultural framework of the people adopting it. Contrast Egypt's resistance with Europe's elaboration.
Europe went all in. Ironworking slowly spreads across Europe between the 11th century BC and 500 BC. And the cultures there, specifically the Hallstatt and Latène cultures, don't just use iron for utilitarian swords. They turned the metallurgy into a high art form.
They really did.
The sources describe how European metalwork shifted from casting molten metal in molds to hammering raw iron into these elaborate, curvilinear, flowing shapes.
They completely mastered the malleability of the metal. But beyond art, iron completely revolutionized their community structures and their relationship with the environment.
How so?
Well, with tougher iron axes and plows, they could clear dense European forests much faster, they could farm heavier clay-rich soils, and construct massive earthworks.
The hill forts. Sources mention Maiden Castle in Dorset, England. This thing is a massive, sprawling fortification with complex, labyrinthine earthwork defenses.
It's a marvel of ancient engineering.
And it's just one of over 2,000 Iron Age hill forts built in Britain alone. While Egypt is shunning iron because of desert gods, Europe is using it to completely terraform their landscape and build heavily fortified, localized societies.
It shows how a single technological breakthrough fractures into wildly different cultural expressions depending on who is wielding the hammer.
Absolutely.
But if we want to talk about shattering expectations of how history works, we really have to look entirely outside the Mediterranean and European spheres.
We need to talk about Asia, and specifically India, because they didn't just learn to smelt iron, they became absolute masters of its chemistry.
Oh, for sure.
The sources detail how, as early as 300 BC, Indian metallurgists were producing incredibly high-quality steel using the crucible technique.
This was a massive leap in applied chemistry.
Yeah.
Instead of just hammering carbon into a bloom, Indian metalworkers would take high-purity wrought iron, mix it with specific carbon-rich organic materials like wood and leaves, and then add glass.
Glass.
Yeah. They would place all of this inside a clay crucible, seal it completely shut, and bake it in a furnace.
They essentially created a pressurized chemical vacuum chamber out of clay. That blows my mind.
It's incredible. The glass acts as a flux, melting down and pulling any remaining impurities out of the iron. Inside that sealed, oxygen-deprived environment, the iron absorbs the carbon from the organic matter perfectly and uniformly.
Wow.
The result was a premium high-carbon steel, often referred to later as Wootz steel, that was highly sought after across the ancient world.
Then you have China, which flips the script in a completely different way.
Right.
The sources note that China developed a fully functioning written language before they ever started smelting iron.
Right.
And because their bronze casting technology and furnace designs were already so phenomenally advanced, I mean, capable of reaching incredibly high temperatures, they bypassed the primitive bloomery stage entirely.
They went straight to the next level.
Exactly. They transitioned almost directly into producing cast iron during the Qin dynasty.
The traditional markers we use to define the Iron Age just don't map neatly onto the Chinese historical record. But the most staggering departure from the standard historical narrative actually happens in sub-Saharan Africa.
When I was reading this part of the source material, I mean, I actually had to stop and reread it.
The timeline is crazy, right?
Sub-Saharan Africa had no universal Bronze Age. Across vast swaths of the continent, they transitioned directly from using stone tools to smelting iron. They bypassed the copper and bronze eras entirely.
Entirely.
Archaeologists have found evidence of independent iron smelting inventions at a site called Leja in Nigeria and in the Central African Republic, dating as far back as 2000 BC.
2000 BC. That is 8 centuries before the Bronze Age collapse in the Mediterranean forced the issue there.
But wait, how does a civilization hit 1250 degrees Celsius without the stepping stone of bronze kilns.
Through brilliant indigenous pyrotechnology.
Okay.
Rather than relying on the forced air bellows used in the Mediterranean, many African metalworkers constructed tall, natural draft furnaces out of clay.
Like chimneys.
Exactly like massive chimneys.
Man.
As the fire burned inside, the shape of the furnace naturally drew oxygen in through tubes at the bottom called tuyeres at incredibly high speeds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The physics of the chimney effect created the intense heat required to smelt iron ore without needing centuries of bronze working as a precursor.
This technology then spread south and east across the continent with the Great Bantu expansion. But, I mean, this completely breaks the neat little timeline we're taught in school.
It does.
How can historians even continue to use the three-age systems, Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, if a massive continent like Africa just bypassed bronze entirely and figured out advanced natural draft iron smelting on their own? Doesn't that make the terminology obsolete?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are hitting on a major debate in modern archaeology.
Yeah, like.
Yeah. The three-age system was literally invented in the 1830s by a Danish museum curator named Christian Jurgensen Thompson. He was just trying to organize a disorganized pile of artifacts in a display case in Copenhagen.
That's hilarious.
Right. It is a 19th century European construct designed to explain European history.
Yet it gets applied to the whole world as if it's a universal law of human development.
That is the fundamental flaw. History is not a neat, linear staircase where every civilization takes the exact same steps at the exact same time. It is a messy, localized web of adaptation.
So Africa didn't skip a step?
Africa didn't skip a step because there were no required steps. They had abundant iron ore, they developed brilliant furnace engineering, and they solved the problem in front of them without needing to wait for a tin supply chain that didn't exist in their region. It highlights how human ingenuity is parallel, not just sequential.
It radically reframes the whole narrative. So let's recap this incredible journey for you listening right now. Mm. We started with ancient elites scavenging alien meteorites just to make jewelry. We move into the intense thermodynamic chemistry of carbon steel, jamming tiny carbon marbles into an iron ball pit, which was only discovered because a catastrophic global supply chain crisis severed the tin routes.
An incredible chain of events.
Right. And then we saw Egypt religiously boycott the new metal out of fear of desert gods, while Europe used it to terraform their landscape into thousands of massive hill forts. And finally, we saw how innovators in India engineered pressurized clay crucibles and how metal workers across sub-Saharan Africa completely shattered the European timeline by building towering draft furnaces to invent iron smelting independently.
It is a remarkable testament to adaptability under pressure. And, you know, it brings up a fascinating point about how this era officially concludes.
Oh, how does it end?
In the archaeological record, the Iron Age technically ends not because we stopped using iron. I mean, obviously, our modern world is built on steel.
Yeah, we use it every day.
Right. It ends because a region enters the historical record.
Oh, I see. The era is defined by the dirt and the metal until the ink takes over.
Exactly. The transition from prehistory to history. So the Iron Age ends in the ancient Near East around 550 BC with the written histories of Herodotus. In Central and Western Europe, it ends with the Roman conquests in the first century BC. Because the Romans brought meticulous written administration with them.
They loved their paperwork.
They really did. And in Scandinavia, the Germanic Iron Age doesn't end until around 800 AD, right at the dawn of the Viking Age. The metal remains, but the way humanity documents its memory permanently changes.
Which is wild to think about.
This raises an important question for you to consider as we wrap up.
Okay.
If the ancient Iron Age officially ended because humanity began leaving behind written records instead of just metal artifacts in the soil, how will future archaeologists define our current age?
Oh, that's a good question.
We live in an incredibly digitized world, but digital data is staggeringly fragile. If our servers degrade, our hard drives fail, and our cloud records are wiped out by the immense span of time, what will be left for the archaeologists of the year 10,000 to find?
Not much data, probably.
Right. Will they look back at the rusted skeletons of our steel skyscrapers, the metal chassis of our electric cars, and simply call us a second, much taller Iron Age?
Second Iron Age.
Wow. We think we are at the top of the escalator, but we might just be leaving behind a slightly more complicated layer of rust for the next civilization to dig up.
Exactly.
That is a thought that is going to stay with me for a long time. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.